Hello and welcome to Tech A. I'm John Beeler, and this is episode 4. And today my guest is Jillian Shaw. She is the digital life journalist for the Vancouver Sun. She covers a lot of different things, including tech primarily. And that's actually how I first met Jillian. We were both at a press briefing for some product. And I just kept bumping into her, and we became friends over the years. And thought this would be a good chance to sit down and have a bit of a deeper dive chat with her. And she is up for an award. She's just about to head off to Ottawa to the awards ceremony, and we'll touch on that a little bit. And so enjoy my chat with Jillian. So I'm here with Jillian Shaw, and where are we, Jillian?
Oh, we're in this podcast studio deep in the in the bowels of our building here at 200 Granville. This is where the Vancouver Sun is. The Vancouver Sun and the province are in the same building, and I work for the Vancouver Sun. And we have this great little podcast studio, which is somewhat bigger than a closet, John, but not a lot more.
Well, it's all you need for a podcast, I guess. And I was just here on Jillian's podcast talking about 3D printing, so I thought I would, you know, take an opportunity and chat with her a little bit about technology. And you know, we've been friends for quite a long time in the local Vancouver tech scene. I think we first met at a TV demonstration or some kind of product demo of some kind, and we've sort of been friends ever since. And so why don't you just sort of start off by telling us how you got into being the Vancouver Sun tech reporter?
That's kind of interesting, John, because, you know, I've heard the story about how you got your first computer back in the 1980s. And when I got into technology, I found an interest in technology, it was kind of along the same lines. It was at a time that was back in the early 1980s. This really dates me, but I got to tell you, John, the first computer that I was writing on, I remember writing in university, and I thought this was just the bee's knees. The computer was a $25,000 computer. It wasn't mine, but I happened to be staying with people that, you know, had some big job, and so it had one of the very early desktop computers, and I got to write my journalism assignments on it. I thought that was very cool.
Do you remember what kind of computer it was?
You would have remembered, John, and I don't. Although I do remember I had the very first Apple.
Yeah.
I had the first Apple computer. And it was only because I was an early adopter. Like, I really liked how things worked and trying to figure it out. So even with my first Apple computer, I remember learning to take it apart because I had to do something. I had to fix it, or I can't even remember. I think I wanted to change the hard drive. I can't remember now what I was doing, but I was so thrilled to think that I could actually take it apart, change it, make it work, and then all the software side of it. And also, I think because I'm a journalist and in communications, what fascinated me so much, and from the very beginning, was how computers just made it so easy to communicate. So I was on early bulletin boards, and I remember emailing at a time when the only person I knew who had an email was my brother-in-law in Edmonton. So I thought, so I would write to my sister because she didn't have her own email, and I had to write to my brother-in-law at some obscure email address over a dial-up connection. And then it just kind of grew from there. And so then, at the time, technology was something you did at the side. It wasn't part of our everyday life. That was the first cell phones were the size of bricks, and computers cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And now it's become just part of what we do every day, all the time. It's not, technology's not a part of our life or this section. In our newspaper, technology used to have its own section.
Yeah.
That's how, because it was, you talked, technology was totally separate. It wasn't part of everyday life. Well, now it's everything we do, right?
Well, in your column's Digital Life, is it not?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, the virtualization of our lifestyles, I guess.
Exactly.
So you've always been really interested in newer, better ways of communicating and getting your ideas across and that type of thing, like right from school, I guess, with that $25,000 computer.
With the $25,000 computer.
So we spent a lot of time, you and I, together playing with new cell phone technology and stuff like that. Do you ever find yourself feeling a little, you know, jaded about it? Or it's like, oh, I have to see another cell phone this week that, you know, ups the ante just this little bit? Like, do you find yourself getting kind of bored with some of this stuff? Or is it still exciting for you after doing it for a while?
Do you know, John, I love doing what I do. And I have an editor, Adrienne Tanner. She talks about, oh, there's Jill. She just goes out after those bright, shiny new things. And I haven't lost that fascination for bright, shiny new things. And I find myself in a newsroom. I love talking to you, John, and other people who are, you know, techie friends and geeks, because we kind of share the same. I can tell you something about some new thing I've discovered or some new app or something I'm playing with, and you kind of share the excitement. But I've got to tell you, when I'm in the newsroom, sometimes I'll run to my editor and say, oh, look at this great, cool, you know, gee whiz gadget. And they'll look at me like, oh, there she goes again.
The eye rolling. What do we
need this for? But I haven't lost that kind of thrill.
Yeah.
I hope I never do.
Me too. Yeah. It's really hard to quantify sometimes, because definitely there is a lot of stuff out there that we get to see that you can't put a quantifiable, actionable reason for getting it, but it's new and shiny, so you have to play with it at least. And I think that's part of what I like about what I do with my, you know, my tech blog and stuff, is that I get to play with a lot more stuff than I would if I had to go and buy it all myself. And so I get to sort of try it before I decide to buy it. And I do buy a fair bit of stuff myself, and I am considered an early adopter, but I think that comes with the territory. If you're curious and passionate about technology, you kind of have your hands in a lot of different tech pies, if you will.
Yeah, well, you do. And of course, I mean, you must find it like me. I'm kind of like the person who works in a dress shop and spends their entire salary on what I mean. Yeah. It's hard to be, you get to try out new technology, and then of course you want to have it, because I'll have a cell phone. I'll be using my old cell phone, which now happens to be an iPhone 5. And then I'm trying my old iPhone 5. And then you and I just got a chance to try out the Samsung Galaxy S4. And I went, oh, okay, this is cool. Oh, gee, I like this camera. And I can have turned on the little, you know, S Health application. And all of a sudden now I was tracking all my exercise. And okay, well, gee, do we have to give this up? And you can't be buying a phone every phone every week if you tried to keep up. But
well, yeah, this seems to be the new cell phone season for us, because I had a Sony last week, and then this past week I had the S4, and who knows what we're gonna have next week now too. So
that's right.
And the new iPhone is rumored to be just around the corner. So it's this constant leapfrogging of technology. And we talked a little bit about it on Steve Dotto's show, but you know, one of the problems with some of this technology is the rapid deployment of it. You know, like, you know, Samsung seems to have a new cell phone every couple of months, and you know, Apple has a new iPhone pretty much annually since they launched in 2007. But what's recently sort of made you want to switch to something new? You know, the problem for me that I have with the Apple stuff, and the Apple iPhone is the one I spend money on, because I've got a fairly significant investment in the iTunes store and the apps and that things. And I don't want to have to buy all those same apps again on the Samsung side if I was to go down the S4, which, you know, as of this recording, the S4 was definitely the best Android phone I've played with in a long time. And I think I liked it for different reasons than you or Steve did too. So it's interesting that a phone like that can be compelling for a number of different reasons, not just because it's the best or the latest, you know, for five more minutes.
Exactly.
And so for you, I mean, you said that you're heavily invested on the iPhone side, but what was the last piece of technology that made you excited or made you feel like you had to have it, you know, and not part of your day job?
No, that's a difficult thing to say, because I've been trying out a new podcast mic, which I really liked, but that I can use that in work. What I find, and in what I write, is that I'm really interested in not just technology for its own sake, but how it can change your life and make your life better. Trying to put my hand on a piece of technology that I'm really excited about and is making my life better at this moment. This is actually, you know, one of the things I do when I'm not writing is I sail.
Yes.
I'm a sailor. So, and we have a sailboat. And for years, even though I'm I write about leading edge technology, I had a sailboat that didn't have any plugged in navigation system and radar and all that. Even though I write about it, know about it, and I would have my little navigation on my iPad and also use the rulers and would set a course on paper charts. So I, even though I knew the technology, I can figure out my GPS and set a course on paper charts. So, but finally this year I broke down at the boat show and got this great screen that's even bigger than my iPad that's now wired right into the boat, and it has a sonar on it so I can see what the bottom looks like, and it has radar on it so I can hopefully avoid islands like some BC ferries weren't able to do. And all of these things, all on a screen that looks like a little mini TV on the boat. And I think that's not just technology. I don't have that just because it's golly gee whiz fun to have.
Yeah, it's not just shiny. It's
it's not just bright, shiny, new. That can really, that could save your life sometime when you're out, when you're out sailing.
It's interesting you mention it, because I often think about how we interacted before social media, before smartphones, and you mentioned, you know, charting a course literally with a pen and or a pencil and a ruler on a map. And that's really interesting that, you know, not everybody needs technology. And I think that's something that a lot of people forget about, is that just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it with new technology. There's some really good things you can do the old way that still work fine, and you don't have to keep charging them and, you know, that kind of thing, right? Like, you don't need power for that pencil. And I've actually found myself thinking a lot more about how we interacted before all this technology. And you know, for me, I mean, it really seemed like around the 80s is when the technology sort of really started affecting my life. You know, I was obsessing about computers and video game systems and all this type of stuff around the 80s when I was, you know, a teenager, basically, to date myself. And the notion of not having technology is really compelling. I spent the weekend at a friend's house on an island just west of Bowen Island.
I saw that on Facebook.
Yeah. And, you know, we had spotty to no cell service, and the entire island has no power. The whole place is run by solar panels. And I thought, okay, this is a perfect opportunity to just disconnect. I'm not saying I didn't check my email when I could get a service or upload a photo of, you know, to Instagram or whatever, but it was really quite nice to sort of chill. And there was about 20 of us there, so it's lots of people to interact with. But it was really interesting how basically going on a boat, and it was like a time machine. When we arrived there, is, you know, this place was built in the 40s. It feels like I had been on a time machine because nothing had changed. There was no big screen TV, or, you know, it was just chairs and tables and, you know, kitchen, a little bit of infrastructure for, you know, propane power for the stove and that type of thing. But it was really almost, it was very thought provoking for me, and spending time in that type of environment and stripping away all the technology that I love to be around. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love having 18 computer screens going and all kinds of this and that happening at the same time. But it was actually quite fun to disconnect for a while. And the same thing with camping too. I mean, I did buy a camp stove that will charge your iPhone for you. So.
Oh, you would. You would, John.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, it's I don't think like you said, it's just something that we've always sort of had in us. And I'm a firm believer that there's certain people that are just sort of, they have that geek gene, if you will, and they're always interested in the latest and the greatest technology. And whether they use it or not is a different story. It's just constantly improving and adding to your repertoire of technology is interesting. But it was a really good opportunity to sort of step back from that this past weekend. So.
Well, that idea of a digital detox, I think...
And you probably do that all the time when you're on your sailboat, right?
I'm fascinated by that whole... by that idea. And it was only... it only came to me by... I think I told you I about that, John. I was on vacation, and of course I write about technology all the time, social media, you know, writing about the introduction of social media and how people, you know, you and I have been Twitter pals since the time when people were only posting what they ate for breakfast, and there was only a few of us on it. But then I realized in writing that I was watching people who were sharing their stories. They were sharing so much with their social network that you could tell that the people they were with were getting very little of their attention. And so when I went on a holiday, I went on a holiday with my family, and I thought, I don't want to be the person that is sending out these great, look at these great photos, this video I'm taking as I'm, you know, touring Cinque Terre or wherever, and meanwhile my family is seeing the back of my head because I'm busy taking my videos. So I made a conscious decision to kind of disconnect, and for somebody who's always on social media and talking and connecting with people all the time online, whether it's email, social media, wherever it is, that was really a big thing for me to do. And I cheated a little bit, because at one time we were driving around England, and it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we had no place to stay that night. So I pulled out my little computer I was carrying at the time, or like tablet, and booked ourselves a place to stay that night. But for everything else,
But you didn't check Facebook.
I didn't check Facebook. Yeah. I stayed offline. And I didn't think that much. I didn't think anybody else would notice except me. And when I came back, it was very funny because I came back to people saying, "What happened to Jillian? What? Anybody know where Jillian's gone? Is she okay?" And I joked. I think it wasn't a joke. People thought that the son had sent me to the Betty Ford Clinic, and we just weren't saying anything. But it really made me realize. I thought, "Hey, wait a sec. Are we so connected that if we disappear, it's like." If we disappear from online, it's like we've disappeared completely.
Well, it's interesting. Who notices that you disappear if you don't tell anybody before you disappear? How long does it take your friends to realize, hey, where's Jill?
Yeah, and do they, I mean, so it makes you think, what, could you just leave some pre-programmed tweets behind or some pre-programmed Facebook posts or pictures, and people will think, and you could go away for 6 months. People might not even start to look for you.
That's an interesting... I'm sure somebody's trying that theory out right now. Somebody we're interacting with is not replying back to us. They're just on a digital detox.
They're on a digital detox. I think there's something to be said for that. I think we all, even though I am so immersed in it and I love technology, I get up every morning and love what I do and love learning something new every day. But I do recognize that there's times that you have to just relate to the people who are... in real life, like you and I are talking here.
Yeah.
And we get together every once in a while. We don't just interact over Facebook and Twitter. And I think that's really important. And I don't want to lose that. I don't want to be so immersed in my online life that I that is replacing the real life contact.
Well, the thing that Facebook can't do is give you a real hug. You know, just writing hug is one thing, but I know every time I see you, I get a big hug from you, and you just can't get that any other way. And so I don't think that's ever going to replace that, but it definitely makes, you know, the digital interactions that we have, we sort of stay on top of what's going on with people's lives. So then when we do see each other, we can talk about other things as opposed to getting caught up, right? And I think that's an interesting way to think about how I keep on top of my friends on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And, you know, I've said this before, is like, you know, you see someone that you haven't seen for a while and it's like, hey, what's new? It's like, well, you liked what I said on Facebook. Like, look, we both know what's going on, but we can actually, you know, enjoy each other's company in person and have a hug or have a meal or a drink or whatever. And it's a very different experience than having a quick chat on Facebook or a few tweets back and forth.
And yeah, you shouldn't have to get caught up. But doesn't that bring its own pressure, John? I mean, do you ever find yourself running into somebody that you haven't seen for a while and you know that you should know what happened and whether their cat died or their mother-in-law has moved or what, and you find yourself going, oh my God, what did I miss? What do I not know?
How did I miss that?
Yeah, how did I miss that? I've actually seen some things on Facebook and I think, oh, how did I miss that happening?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's part of it is you can't keep on top of everybody. I mean, one of the things that I do with Facebook is I actually, all my really close friends that I really care about, Facebook has this close friends option. And so I get pop-up notifications of everything these people do. And I haven't turned anyone off yet. Even though, you know, I have a few friends that are pretty prolific Instagrammers and things like that, it's still nice to know that there's another person on the other side of my smartphone that's creating content or taking photos and stuff. I don't necessarily have to read them all. I just know that they're still alive and that they're doing something fun in the world. And that's good enough for me, you know, and then I have an easy way of going in and sort of keep on top of them. But yeah, definitely. And the funny thing is you forget how public your stuff is, or not public, but if you have a lot of friends or, you know, you tweet about a lot of your stuff, you forget that you told everybody on your friends list what you just did yesterday. And so when you see them in a week, like, oh, hey, how was that thing? And it's like, oh yeah, I forgot I posted.
How did you know I was there?
Yeah. You just sort of forget that you do stuff like that. Yeah. And you leave these digital breadcrumbs behind you everywhere. And, you know, sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. And the same thing happens with your friends too. And so I always have to couch, like I Monday morning, I go back into work and I chat with a coworker who we're friends on Facebook and, oh yeah, I saw that thing you did, or he says the same thing about, you know, whatever I did, or sometimes we don't see each other, what each other did, because we were all doing our own thing and not Facebooking it and that type of thing. And so it's just really interesting, the interactions. And I talked about this with Steve Dotto, how the technology is forcing the human race to sort of evolve how they're interacting and communicating with each other. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I know some people think it's a horrible thing, but I think it draws people closer together by having these digital tabs on everybody, you know, all your friends and people that you care about. So that means that when you do get some personal face-to-face time, it's much more meaningful. At least it is to me.
Yeah. And you can stay in touch with people you otherwise, I mean, how many friends could you kind of keep in constant contact with, or that you're separated by distance, so all you can do at one point, all you could do was write a letter, or then you could email, or you could pick up the phone. But now you can feel, even if somebody's very far away.
Well, when I was young, I moved away from a small town I lived in, and there was a couple of close friends of mine. And, you know, this was like teenage years, so they're formative friends, you know, people in your life that have an impact, and you move away, and this is before the internet, and you know, you start writing letters back and forth to try to maintain that connection, but eventually it fades for most people. I know some people have lifelong pen pal friends that, you know, and that's great. It just never happened for me for whatever reason, but Facebook lets you sort of reconnect and maintain those relationships much differently than you know, I have cousins in England that I keep in touch with much more often than I ever did when they lived in Canada, you know, so it's kind of crazy how that works and how it sort of turns itself on its head that way.
Yeah, that's right. It brings us close. Well, it just erases the geographic boundaries, right? Completely.
Yeah. Yeah. And even more so when we're all in space and doing other things, we'll be able to have Skype chats and that type of thing. So let's shift gears a little bit. And one of the things that I always liked about you is you're not just a tech journalist. You're actually a real journalist, and you've done a number of very compelling stories recently that you're being recognized for, which I know you're a little humble to talk about because of the nature of it. But I think it's really interesting that, you know, you're a true journalist in every sense of the way, and that you write stories that really mean things to people. And what you bring to your tech conversations too. Like the digital lifestyle stuff is really compelling to me because you put it in perspective for them, as opposed to just here's a press release and here's a new toy that you need to buy. It's like, this is a toy you need to buy and this is why, right? And this is how it can, when I say toy, I mean gadget, technology, whatever. But it's just really interesting how you're able to sort of wear both hats and, you know, be, I'm using air quotes, a real journalist as well as being a tech journalist, which, you know, product reviews and playing with cell phones is a little different than dealing with, you know, heartbreaking bullying cases and other big issues that really affect people on a completely different level than what we typically think of when we think of a tech journalist or a tech blogger.
Yeah, I do. I cover an area, and so I'm really fortunate to be working for a major media organization for Post Media and the Vancouver Sun that lets me. I don't write just about the latest greatest cell phone or what's happening. I write about I can be writing about all kinds of digital life, and that is such a, you know, it's both a, it's a double-edged sword because there's no way, you know, you can cover everything that's going on, but also I have the freedom and also the ability to go into a lot of different areas. One of the areas that I cover a lot is just sort of the impact of our digital life. And and very tragically, a story that came up last October, October 10th, when Amanda Todd, the young teen who took her own life after it was actually online sexual exploitation and then bullying that was both online and in person, brought her to the point where she ended her own life. And I wrote about that, and it was a really, it was a not a, a first for me writing about a suicide, I have to say, but John, we don't cover suicides in the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And traditionally, I mean, if you think about it, think of any mainstream media, you don't, suicides happen, you don't read about them in the news or traditionally years back. Social media has actually changed that because some very high profile suicides are now talked about. Now everyone is a publisher. And so as journalists, then we had to make the decision, do we cover this or do we don't? And I have to say, John, that's also very controversial. The Association of Canadian Psychiatrists would, one of their sort of rules is, and for journalists, is they would prefer that we don't talk about suicides or publish pictures with very good reason. They have very, you know, concerns over copycats and things like that. So on the morning I learned of Amanda Todd's death, it was actually through social media, which has become so much part of my working life and the rest of my life. There's not a dividing line. And I think I read about it probably on Facebook because it was her cheerleading group that posted a very, you know, sad post about her death. And at the time, I didn't even know that it was for real. I mean, who, you know, it was going around the internet. I talked to my editors about it, and I think this debate was going on in newsrooms all over, whether this was something to publish or not. And I took a look. I watched Amanda's video, and I thought this child, or little, you know, a little more than a child, she was 15 years old. She wanted to tell this story. She went on YouTube, and that video was watched millions and millions of times. But at the time, it had only been watched, when I looked at it, it was only a couple of thousand people had seen it, or it had been viewed a couple of thousand times. But I looked at it, and I watched what the message she was trying to convey, and I thought, she is now dead, but she wanted this story to get out. And I think part of our job as journalists is to shine a light on the dark corners.
Yeah.
And bring voice to people who may not otherwise have a voice. And so that was when I published one of the first pieces of writing, one of the first stories on Amanda Todd's death. And from there, I was actually came to meet Amanda's mother, Carol. And that was also through social media because we were on the same, we were Twitter Twitter network pals, because we were both, again, in technology. She in the school system as a teacher, and she specializes in technology and adaptive technology and sort of all the things for the school board where she is working, and I write in technology. And so that was how we connected. And I think it was a tweet that Carol posted that indicated, I didn't even know at the time I didn't know who Carol was. It was C. Todd tweeting. At first I thought it was maybe her father. I didn't know her father and mother's name. It was like, and there's a whole lot of kind of investigative journalism that all journalists were going through that day to try to source the story. And we, in our newsroom, we went through the same process. And I posted the blog post on it. I posted Amanda's video, and sometime in the middle of the day, YouTube took the video down.
Yeah.
And I was a bit surprised, and I thought, I wonder why they've done that. I wondered if it had something to do with the music and copyright. Who knew? I just had no idea. And I think I saw a tweet. That was when I saw a tweet from Carol. And I tweeted that the video had been taken down and that I was going to call YouTube and find out which is what journalists do. We need an answer. We pick up the phone and we call. And I called, and in a very short time, I called and I emailed. And in a very short time, I got a response from YouTube, and they said, it was a mistake. The video is back up. And so Amanda's video, and I tweeted about that, and Carol saw that. And I think it was from that we ended up actually having a conversation on the phone later that evening. She called me, and that was when she started to tell me the story of her daughter, which we published with a lot of other things, but we published in the paper about Amanda's story. And we were honored to be named as finalists in the National Newspaper Awards that are coming up. But as I've told you, and as you can see, and I've told Carol that, well, it's an honor to be named for this award, or to be named a finalist for this award for our newspaper. It's a story that no journalist ever wants to cover.
Yeah, yeah. You'd rather get an award for talking about the new smartphone as opposed to the unfortunate death of someone. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when the story broke, and I remember you being all over it and doing what you do really well. And I know a lot of people got a lot out of that. So the positives, I think, outweigh the sadness or the negatives, I guess, of doing that type of thing and helping to share that story. And that's really what I think you do really well, whether it's the latest smartphone or it's a tragic circumstance. But it's really interesting to see how you're able to sort of shift gears and do everything, you know, not just one thing. So I applaud you for that. And that's why I like that we're friends, because you're very talented and very skilled at what you do. So.
Well, thank you, John. I'm blushing here behind the microphone. It's a good thing we're not on video.
That's right. Yes. So let's switch gears again, because, you know, it's the Todd story is a very sad story. But we talked about, you know, the last piece of technology that you got excited about, which was your
has to do with sailing, of course.
Your sailing,
right?
Yeah. But what technology has let you down lately? Has there been anything that's really let you down? I mean, I know we were trying to get some phones working before, and the building let us down because it seems to be a big Faraday cage of blockage for getting a cell connectivity in your own building.
Well, that's funny. Some things that let me down. You know, you do hear me say this, John. Like, I kind of gripe about technology. Like, it's so great and it's so awful at the same time. I actually was thinking about that. I was helping a friend. This is just, and you realize you can't live without it, but it's a lot of times things don't work smoothly. This was just something really simple. And I realized, and these are our audience, and in fact, for both of us, the people that we're talking to can be anybody from people like yourself who are, you know, really savvy in technology, to people who are still trying to figure out, you know, basically loading apps on their new tablet or whatever it is they're trying to do. So there's a really wide range. And I was reminded of that. I was trying to help somebody who was, all she was doing was sending a, adding a PowerPoint attachment to a to an email, and it was getting stuck. And I actually think, you know, after taking a look, finding she didn't have antivirus software, taking a look to see, you know, taking a look at a few things to see what was going wrong, and I concluded it was actually her internet coverage and her internet connection, and switched her onto a hotspot on my iPhone, turned my iPhone into a hotspot to make it work. But the whole experience is 20 minutes or so we spent trying to do some very, very simple thing, and which for her was a bit of a mystery, right?
Yeah.
I thought, well, why isn't it this works? And I was thinking, and I do know what I'm doing when, you know, around this, I thought, you're right, this shouldn't be like this. It should be seamless. And so many times we have to either know something, but maybe this is just growing pains,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like nobody used to be able to program their VCR. Well, we don't have VCRs anymore. Now we have PVRs, and isn't that easy? Because you can just hit a little button on your phone and to start recording,
yeah.
and it just works. My biggest thing that I hate is passwords. I can't stand passwords, and I know that you're supposed to use, you know, your password one or your whatever password keeper that you use. But
yes, one password, I think.
Technology can have its own demands, right?
Yeah, yeah. I choose not to use that type of a system because, like you, I get to play with lots of different things. And typically, the thing I need, if I want to install, say, Facebook on the new smartphone, there may not be a one password app for it yet. So I can't rely on having that or trying to memorize a 30 character password. So I have a system, but it's definitely, it always seems to be something that is very top of the list for technical and non-technical people, it seems. So the whole security aspect of the security layer on everything, if we didn't have to worry about passwords, it'd be a much easier place to navigate, and the technology would be a lot easier to use. But that's interesting. The funny thing is that what you said is that, you know, you spent 20 minutes trying to do something that should have been, you know, 10 seconds,
yeah.
Right? And it's just that whole troubleshooting process that the average person doesn't know what they don't know. So it's like, well, is it the internet? Is it what I'm, something I'm trying to do, and that type of thing? And I think you're right. It is probably growing pains, but it's a perpetual growing pain. Like, we're always introducing something new that is going to cause a problem, you know, whether it's too many Wi-Fi hotspots that's drowning out your internet connection. You know, I live in a complex of about 50 units, and I swear there's at least 50 Wi-Fi hotspots there. So, you know, it's a very clustered and cluttered wireless spectrum that I'm dealing with. And that's probably contributing why I only get, if I'm lucky, one bar of Rogers on my cell phone in my house.
Well, you know, I had a very funny thing, and this is a very funny thing happened exactly like that. And here we are. I was at a very big tech event. I was at the launch of the Galaxy 4S in New York City at Radio City. I have to tell you, John, the biggest problem I had was getting a signal so that I could actually file a story to say, yeah. I was there. And I thought, how ironic is this? And it was because of exactly that, because
yeah.
We all had our hotspots going. And I had that great little gadget from, I love little gadgets that just work. That was that Roam Mobility.
Yeah, the Liberty hotspot. Yep.
The Liberty hotspot from Vancouver's own. We have to give a Vancouver company a plug here. Roam Mobility has a little hotspot. And I had that plugged in, but of course, unfortunately, everybody else had their hotspots plugged in. And there we go. We have the means of communicating with the world, but we were stopped by, you know, just really mundane things. And it actually, I was sitting beside the vice president of Samsung Canada, and I had my laptop, and I had my hotspot, and I had my iPhone. And first of all, I couldn't get a signal to come out, and then the battery on my computer, which I swore I had completely charged up, the battery gave out, John. So you have to imagine this. I'm gone to New York. I'm the tech writer for The Sun and Post Media News. And I'm sitting there without a connection to the internet and with my computer powered down. So we went running to the very nice people at Samson. Take me, we find an outlet and we're about to plug it in. And one of the ushers at the Radio City Music Hall said, "Well, you can't do that." We said, "Well, we need some power for this." "Oh, we turn all the plugs off during events." Can you imagine? I ended up filing my story from the drugstore across the street where I was sitting between the cosmetics and the shampoo with somebody from Samson while I filed my story back to Vancouver.
That's hilarious. It's always the most mundane thing that sabotages our technology.
So. I had the technology. I had every kind of gadget. I was going to be able to communicate to the entire world, and I was defeated by the lack of a plug.
Well, and that's always the biggest joke at a tech conference is the fact that the Wi-Fi always sucks. And it's like, yeah, you would think they would have that figured out.
Yeah. We can land people on the moon and have them live, in space, why can't we have Wi-Fi that works?
We can tweet to the people in the space.
People in space can tweet, and we can't get a Wi-Fi connection around the block. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Jillian. It was great chatting with you. I think we covered a lot of different things, and I hope you had a good time.
It's fun chatting, and I look forward to getting together again, John.
Great. Thanks, Jillian. Thanks again for listening. It was great chatting with Jillian about all kinds of different things. One thing I really like about these podcasts is that I don't really have a script or an agenda when I start the chat, and we sit down and we just try to have a conversation, and hopefully it comes across on the podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. And my thanks again to Jillian Shaw from the Vancouver Sun for sitting down with me today, and we'll see you next time. We'll be right back.